When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All these generals have been losing wars since Korea, right? And they all write these books, and they all get to like go and teach at Princeton and Columbia and you name it. I'm not calling anybody out, but Petraeus, you know, that guy, he's like, I'm going to cheat on my wife. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
Columbia will still bring me in. And they do these victory laps after 1 year, 2 years, and then you realize that none of the stuff that they did actually worked.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We got a special guest today, Morgan Lorett. You got a new book out, Girls, Guns, and Greed. I was a Blackwater mercenary in Iraq. But before we get to that, let's talk about you for a bit. Tell me where you're from.
I'm from the metropolis of Cottonwood, Arizona. You've probably never heard of it, but it's close to Sedona.
Is that a metropolis?
A thriving metropolis.
Isn't metropolis the home city in Megamind or whatever the fuck that cartoon thing was? Think that was. So are you a super villain or a superhero, would you say?
Definitely a villain.
Okay. Yeah. And how do you distinguish between the two? Because it's not always easy.
Well, I was in FFA in Cottonwood, so definitely villain stuff.
And FFA?
Yeah, Future Farmers of America. Those guys are all the villains, right?
I thought farmers were good people.
Yeah, the farmers are, but the future farmers, man, you can't trust them.
What are they, like socialists or something?
Well, they're all
into, like... Is
it
the World Economic Forum of the farmer community?
Well, everybody, when you turn 16, everybody gets a pair of Velcro gloves to hold onto the sheep better. So you can
I see.
Yeah.
So they would have fit in nicely in Iraq and Afghanistan then.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, absolutely.
Very adaptable people. Wait, tell me again the name of the city?
Cottonwood, Arizona.
I feel like I've heard of that before. Maybe it's from the book.
It is
but
from the
book. But I don't know if I've ever... My brain is remembering that, but I don't know why. It's probably the book. I don't think I would have heard of it otherwise, right?
I doubt it, unless you... Well, it's turned itself into wine country somehow. It used to be like downtown is where you would go to get stabbed. And now their little downtown area has like all these nice wineries and stuff. So it's very snooty now, but back in the 90s, it was not a cool place to be.
Well, getting stabbed is underrated, I think, right? You know, most of the good places now are places where people used to get stabbed, and you got to wonder if it's the green grass growing, because that's what we were taught, right?
It's absolutely the green grass growing. But I've been watching a lot of Reacher, and he gets stabbed like every other episode, so it can't be that bad. Look at that guy.
He's massive. O'Neill was talking shit to him on the internet the other day because he said. That Trump is a racist pedophile or some shit, a rapist or something, and people that vote for him are pieces of shit. And Rob was talking shit to him, and then he was like, oh, you're huge, never mind.
Yeah,
whatever
like
you say is right.
6'4", 240.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, he's a big dude. he did try to convince everybody that he didn't get on the junk for that role. I'm like, come on, man. Nobody puts on muscle like that.
Oh, dude. I mean, I talk about it in the book, but like steroids were rampant at Blackwater, and that guy's on the juice. There's no way. That guy's breasts like are the size of Pamela Anderson's. It's amazing to watch.
Yeah, I would like to weigh him just to see. Muscle weighs more than silicone, though, so I imagine he's doing better in that department. So before you were at Blackwater, you were in the Marine Corps?
No,
or
dude,
not the Marine Corps, sorry. In the military is what I meant.
Yeah. No, I was Air Force. I was Air Force Security Forces. I joined up in 99. I joined the National Guard. Mm-hmm.
Was it the Air Guard or just the regular National
Guard? Air Guard.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was like, I want to be a cop. That sounds really cool. Mm. And then you go into the Air Force and you end up just staring at planes all day. No cop work, and make sure like tanks don't roll through the front gate. So that's really all I did for the Air Force. I just happened to meet some dudes in the National Guard. We got activated for 2 years after September 11th. Met a bunch of like Force Recon Marine guys. Mm. And after we got done with our activation, they were like, we're going to go work for Blackwater. And I was like, that sounds insane. Mm. Right? March 04 was when the Blackwater guys got hanged in Fallujah. So I was like, have a great time. Mm. And back then, Blackwater was such a small community. They went to go train. And they said, hey, you got anybody else that can come in here? And they say, I'll call Morgan, like Morgan, the Air Force guy. Mm. So I just got a random call from a random dude from a random number in Virginia that said, hey, you want to come to Blackwater? If you make it through, we'll send you to Iraq. $550 a day, you know, 23-year-old white trash kid from Cottonwood. Jump right on it, man.
Well, what's, before we get into all that, what is the actual pathway to do police work if you join the Air Force as a security forces person? Because really, you're a guard for the first some amount of time, but that's not unlike being a sheriff's deputy where you have to go work the jails for a while, right? I mean, you got to do some bitch work first.
Well, they don't tell you that you're not a cop when they're joining up, right? Like, so they're like, oh, you get to go and you learn all these policing stuff. Mm-hmm. And then after that, it turns out that you're just a gate guard for the most part. But I mean, their sales tactic was great. Like, go become a cop, and then you're in the National Guard, and then you go become a cop at, you know, wherever you want. And I thought, man, that's where I want to be. Mm-hmm. It's not where I wanted to be.
So you got let me go back for a sec. You got called up for deployment with the Air Guard?
Yeah, so after September 11th, everybody got activated in my unit for 2 years, pretty much 2 years straight. So most of it was just hanging out at the base out in Phoenix, and then the deployment started coming. So the first deployment was to Oman, did that in like October through December 02.
And what were you doing, guarding airfields or some shit?
Yeah, just standing there looking at planes, either making sure people don't steal the planes, people don't look funny at the planes, making sure people came through the gate in an orderly fashion. It was pretty intense.
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
And then 2003 hit, we went into Iraq, and the irony is that the first people in Iraq were National Guard guys. Mm. So Security Forces, National Guard, we started the first air base in Iraq, which is Talil. Mm. And once we get there, the war moves so fast, like you could see it with your nods the first few nights. Mm. And then after that, everything was done through Nasiriya. And I sat there and I stared at planes landing, offloading stuff. Pretty good. I had two Leathermans because I was high speed, right? Mm. So I'd grab like a beetle and like an ant, and I'd have the beetle and the ant fight each other while I was watching planes. This is what dumb GIs do when they're E4s sitting in Iraq.
But we do way worse than that.
Well, yeah, that's true.
That's pretty low on the ethical totem pole, I'd say, as far as the weird shit we get up to. But it is, people don't, there's no way, I think maybe Jarhead got it right to some degree. And then Generation Kill to some degree as well, but how fucking boring it is most of the time.
Oh, it's terrible.
It's like, you think about people being at war, it's like, oh, they must be freaked out 24 hours a day. It's like, no, mostly just bored and angry.
Yeah, 99% of the time, just absolute sheer boredom, then 1% adrenaline. What do you do with that 99% of the time? You just sit there and you make up like random things to talk about. Mm. Like, who's going to be the first one to beat off in Iraq? I won that one. I'm just throwing that out there.
Well, you don't want to be a loser.
Yeah.
If you're not first, you're last. Somebody said that.
And then it's like, hey, if you had to sleep with a 400-pound woman or a really pretty man lady from the Philippines, what would you like? What do you do? It's like all these things that will never happen, but they could happen. So you have to discuss them in great detail.
Yeah, the would you rathers get pretty off the rails. And back then, Urban Dictionary was still a thing. That was one of our things. We would like to come up with entries for Urban Dictionary that were just completely fucked. You know, I mean, we were infantry guys, so I think we felt some kind of pressure to be worse than everybody else somehow, it wasn't very difficult because in a lot of ways we were intrinsically horrible people. But so some of the stuff is so boring. And then you get, I guess you can see this from both perspectives, because you were working in big military and then you went to a small contract, what was a smaller contracting outfit at the time. You very rarely know what the fuck is going on, right? Like, you know your little sector of what's going on. I always thought that was a big mistake, the way that we handle lower enlisted folk. You know what I mean? Like, they're more often than not, they're problem solvers. And we give them just enough information to do some menial task, but not enough to think outside the box if shit goes down. It's always been a problem, I think.
Oh, 100%. I mean, there was no strategy. So when I was at Tallil, the Jessica Lynch rescue went down. Mm-hmm. And it stays from Tallil. They took her to the Combat Army Surgical Hospital, the CASH. Had no idea it happened. I didn't know what happened until I got home. And I was like, oh, hey, I was there. I kind of remember those little bird helicopters flying around. And you just – I think we don't give young men the benefit of the doubt. And I was on the enlisted side, and I was also on the officer side later. There's a lot of least common denominator where you're like, okay, that guy's the dumbest guy. I have to explain it to that dumbest guy. And then it kind of kills the other people that have a couple brain cells in their head.
Yeah, it's so sometimes I think it's the same function as withholding information from plebs, you know, throughout human history, just to make sure that if they have to come through you, it's like feudalism, basically intellectual feudalism to some degree. And then some of it is, I think, that these motherfuckers had no idea what they were doing. When I say these motherfuckers, I mean the people that were planning the war, because it didn't seem like they knew what they were doing. This idea that we were going to spread out across Iraq and make people who had never experienced a democratic republic before fall in love with it overnight is the dumbest shit I think that we've done in a long time. I don't know what if it's hubris or ignorance or what to expect an entire group of people just to like, oh yeah, this is better than what we've known for hundreds of years. It's like, is that really what we thought was going to happen? I don't know that we ever thought that was really going to happen.
Well, so take a step back. Let's take the democracy thing out of there. First, it was weapons of mass destruction. Mm. Never showed up. Then when you actually, the fighting starts, that's when politicians, generals, journalists, all those people, they go into like hindsight morality is what I call it for war, where they say, oh, well, we're there, so we have to spread democracy. Mm. Oh, we have to help these little girls go to school. We have to go in and make sure that the Sunnis and the Shias aren't fighting each other. But none of that was the reason for the war itself. So what happens is, as war progresses, and this is almost every war, somebody at some point says, oh, we already kind of did what we wanted to do, so now we have to have a reason to keep doing it or staying. And that's what we got bogged down in Iraq, Afghanistan. It's what we're doing in Syria, Ukraine, you name it. It's like everything, the morality of the war shifts as time goes on.
But it doesn't. Not in reality, right? Like and that's why I like, I don't know if this is a popular or an unpopular opinion, but it is a constitutional opinion. I don't think that we should even have a standing army. Like, the Constitution doesn't codify into law having a standing army or anything like that. It does make room for a navy and then a strategic force alongside that navy to protect shipping and transportation and travel and stuff like that. But to your point about, I guess, I don't know, there are these inflection points where like, oh, you know, we should be doing this, and the whole mission changes, but that's not what the mission was, right? The mission was to fucking root out whatever and then leave.
Right.
Essentially. Same thing in Afghanistan. Like, having to build up the army makes you go through the process of the Powell Doctrine, which is three stages. There's three steps or three criteria that must be met before you go to war. One is that there's popular will to conduct the war, popular amongst the population, right? And the best way to determine popular will is, well, come sign up and fight, right? That's, to me, is the best way to do it. Then a clearly defined victory, what it is specifically, what does victory look like? And then so we can get the fuck out of here. And then three is to apply overwhelming force until you've achieved that goal. Well, I mean, it's beating a dead horse now to say that we didn't do any of those things. in Iraq or Afghanistan, right? Maybe Afghanistan had popular will, but Iraq certainly didn't. I mean, it was not popular even from the beginning. And as somebody who was in it from the early stages, did you have any concept of what it meant to win in either one of those places?
No, absolutely not. There was no strategic. So in corporate America, it's project management, right? You have to have a defined start date and you have to have a defined end to any project. And that's what I'm saying. That number two of the Powell Doctrine, where essentially you have defined goals where you know what victory looks like. We didn't have that. When I went in during the ground offensive, we said, we'll probably be there for a month to 2 months. We're going to wipe everybody out and then we're going to leave. And then everybody just kept staying on the ground. And then 9 month deployments, 12 month deployments, 15 month deployments, where there was no definition of what success was going to look like. And it was through every single command got to spend their time in Iraq. And none of them could have told you exactly what right looked like. I mean, especially as a junior enlisted guy, when's the last time you had like a colonel come down here and say, our job is to, nah, they talk in platitudes.
Yeah.
They say, oh, we're here to spread democracy and we're going to help the people build their schools. And here's where Iraq really fucked up. And I don't know if this is a popular opinion or not, but when we went into Iraq, we didn't want to be seen as occupiers. Mm. So the first thing we did is we set up an interim government and then we handed Iraq over to the interim government. But we got rid of all the Ba'ath Party. So anybody that had run a government before was gone.
Right, yeah.
Air traffic controllers, the financial industry, everybody absolutely gone.
We just brought back dissidents who had left.
Right.
And then come back.
But there was nobody on the ground that knew how to pick up trash, right? Like those guys were all gone. They were part of the Ba'ath Party. So once we gave that over to them, we moved from a DOD mission, so military, to a diplomatic mission because now it was an actual government. Mm. That's where Blackwater comes in.
Right.
Is Blackwater came in there to protect diplomats and other government organizations to get them from point A to point B. So one of the missions we had was go to the Ministry of Interior to go help those guys learn how to do Ministry of Interior stuff, the Ministry of Oil, the Ministry of Minerals, the Ministry of you name it. We're ferrying these people to go teach individuals how to actually run a country. But there was no defined like, hey, we're done with the Ministry of Oil once these guys are actually pumping oil and sending it off to the market. Like there was no strategic way of saying that any of these missions that we were on had anything to do with what an end state was because we didn't have an end state.
Yeah. And the same, I thought we made the same mistake in Afghanistan, to be honest. Like we, when Anaconda first kicked off and we had a small footprint over there, we were just lighting up Al Qaeda training bases and shit, right? And then somehow it turned into a fight against the Taliban. We never should have been at war with the Taliban. That doesn't make any sense. That would be like going to war with the U.S. government to get rid of the like the Bloods and Crips or something. You know what I mean? Like it was just somebody to fight. They were there in the way, so we fought them because we were there and they were there, right? But it didn't like the Taliban. It's not our business to go into Afghanistan and tell the Taliban how to run their country.
Well, what about the little girls that can't go to school?
Yeah,
I mean this is what it comes down to. It's like it's literally adding something moralistic, right? Afghanistan, I think when we went into Iraq, only had 15,000 troops in Afghanistan,
right?
Then we go into Iraq, we get up to 120, we start drawing down from Iraq, we send all those guys to Afghanistan. We still don't do anything, but by God, we feel good because we gave out backpacks and crayons to these little boys and girls that were going to school for the first time, and we were going to build them better lives. And then we left and the Taliban came in and slaughtered all that stuff. But this isn't new, right? Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. What did we do right after that? We kicked the shit out of Germany first.
Yeah.
So it's not, there's always something else that's happening to be able to say, why are we still there? What's the end state? And I don't think we're ever going to fight a war again where that's going to be clearly defined.
I can't think of, there's always the debate, I suppose, of how far you should take it. And it's going on right now with Iran and Israel, right? Like, what should Israel do in retaliation to this after Iran retaliated against them and so on and so on? Yeah, what is a desired end state? I don't know. I mean, it's there are certain people, I think, in human history that it is impossible to live with, right? Like, they just have to go. Pedophiles, shit like that. People that prey on others, dictators, not all of them, but some that are trying to get weapons of mass destruction or commit genocide, I think we should probably look into that, right? But take China, for example. They're adversarial with the United States. Are we really going to go to a war with them? Over what exactly? Because we're adversaries on paper, right?
Well, they control all the fortune cookie supply. Oh, yeah. So let's not.
Yeah, those were invented in,
in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, right? Yeah. yeah, I mean, I don't know. I really don't understand. I know that Taiwan is a big deal because they produce all the world's microprocessors right now. That'll be not the case by 2026, give or take. There's a couple plants going up here in the U.S. But it seems like this whole governmental infrastructure is designed to, just like every other system of government, to extract wealth and labor from the population. That's usually what it comes down to. They just want to tax the shit out of you, right? This episode is brought to you by GhostBed. GhostBed.com/drinkingbros. Go there today and get 50% off site wide. All their mattresses, all the sheets, everything. They've got the GhostBed Classic. They've got the GhostBed 3D Matrix. They've got the GhostBed Lux. And now they've got the new one, the GhostBed Flex Hybrid. All these are cooling mattresses. They're the best in the business. They also have the new technology that we've been looking for all this time. Well, not we, just Joel, which is the RV mattress. Now, if you've got one of these things, you know that you can't find a mattress that fits them appropriately, at least not a good one. And the ones that come with them are terrible. So if you're you know, an RV person, you definitely want to jump on that. And by the way, they got the best pillows in the business. You've heard me say it before, but I travel with these things. That's how good they are. It's kind of a pain in the ass, but not as bad as sleeping on hotel pillows, I'll tell you that much. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros today. Use the code Ghost or Drinking Bros at checkout. You're going to get 50% off all the mattresses. Check them out today. We've been with them for a while. I've got them all over my house. You know they're good. So my best advice here is go for the 3D Matrix. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever slept on in my life. Go get it today. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkingbros. Use the code Drinking Bros. You're going to get 50% off. That's 50% off. You're not going to get a better deal. If I had to choose between Israel and the people trying to fight them, I'm going to choose Israel because they more closely align with my values. But, you know, there's a big argument to send them money and weapons and shit like that. And it's like, well, they pay for them. It's like, yeah, they pay for them with the money we sent them.
No, dude, but what a great business model, right? We send them money, they buy the weapons from us, and then they get to use them. Like, sign me up for that.
Follow that whole train, though, where the money – so the U.S. government robs people. Its citizens, and then gives the money to a foreign government, and then their friends in the military industrial complex sell weapons and get that money back. So it's just, we're just spending money on the military industrial complex with more steps at this point.
Oh, it's a self-licking ice cream cone. And what I will give this to Northrop and all those other defense contractors, they have turned what used to be durable goods, right? Missiles, grenades, bullets. They can sit there in a warehouse for years and years, and they've turned them into consumable goods, literally just-in-time manufacturing to get a bullet, to get a missile, to get anything over to the Ukraine, to Syria, to Israel, and then have them use it within days. Like, that's... You're getting your product out there. Now, I think to your point, it's driving a lot of our foreign policy. There's a ton of people that are sitting there in D.C. that are making a heck of a lot more money than we are that are saying, we need to give those guys more bombs. Mm. You know what they really need? More bombs. It's really going to help them.
Well, it hasn't.
No, not even.
I mean, really. Israel doesn't need our bombs. Frankly, they can handle themselves. But Ukraine is another story. That's not even a real country, really. And nothing we do aside from us invading Russia is going to stop this shit. Like, there's no amount of weapons we can send Ukraine that's going to outlast. They're outnumbered like 10 to 1. Like, that, it's not a fight you can win.
No, right? They absolutely can't win that. Now, what's the morality of that argument now? Because it started out as we want it to where they can repel Russia, so that Russia is not on NATO's doorstep.
I mean, Russia's on. Why are we thinking in terms of siege warfare? People have ICBMs and hypersonic missiles. That's retarded, in my opinion, right? Like the idea that Russia's more dangerous because they're in Ukraine than they were 2 years ago is
That's ridiculous. That's
stupid. They have hypersonic weapons.
Yeah, but now it's about democracy, right? Like, ever since like Vietnam, go back to Korea, it's been about like stopping the spread of communism. And now it's, you know, stopping the spread of something so that we can create democracy. But anybody that spent any time with just basic research of Ukraine from the time that Trump got impeached for it, realize that that was like a completely corrupt government.
Oh, yeah.
It was not a democracy. Let's not sit here and pretend like it's this bastion of democracy that is holding the line against Russia.
Yeah. I mean,
so now it's like we got to keep giving them stuff because that democracy, whew, it's really going to catch on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's it probably started, I guess a lot of people would say that the Kremlin put their guy in back in 2014, I think. And then we put our guy in 2017 after some arrests were made and some weird shit were, you know, who knows what exactly went down over there. But
here's what I find absolutely fascinating by this. Putin has been saying, don't try to expand NATO or else I'm going to go into Ukraine. He's been saying that for years and years and years and years. And it's like this spy versus spy where we're trying to figure out exactly what he's thinking when he's telling us, right?
Right. Yeah.
Like, hey, don't go in there or else I'm going to go into Ukraine. And they're like, well, we want Ukraine in NATO. Like, we just kept poking the bear and poking the bear and poking the bear. And then he goes into Ukraine and we're shocked.
Yeah.
Now, the same thing just happened with Iran. Iran said, hey, you bombed our dude over in Hezbollah in Lebanon. Mm. We're going to send rockets over to Israel. We're going to bomb the piss out of you guys. And we're like, and then they do it and everybody acts like they're shocked. Like,
yeah.
If you just listen, people will tell you what they're going to do.
Yeah, it's and that one specifically, I kind of feel like this latest barrage from Iran is the same thing they did after we killed Soleimani. Like, it's just enough to make their people feel like they did something, but not enough that Israel has a reason to invade or nuke them, frankly. Like, it was like the equivalent of getting slapped in the face by a bigger dude and then fucking making some snide comment as he walks away because he's done with you, right? It's like, I got to do something to save face. And then as the larger party, Israel, you have the opportunity now just to be like, all right, you obviously can't hurt us because you threw everything you had at us and we shot them all out of the sky, so.
Well, I've read, who knows how accurate it is. You guys will do fake news later and tell me I'm lying, but 50% of the projectiles didn't make it over there, right? And then the other 50% got essentially shot down. 7 projectiles actually landed. So from a military standpoint, it was an abject failure.
Right.
It was. Mm-hmm. But what it did is Iran essentially put it on the table for the other Muslim countries, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, UAE. It said, who are you going to be with? Are you going to be with us or are you going to be with the Israelis? Look, they all hate each other over there.
Yeah, yeah.
But they hate the Israelis the most.
Right.
So from a strategy standpoint, the first thing Kuwait, Qatar, a number of countries came out and said, the U.S., you are not going to be able to do strikes from our bases that you have here. So I think it's more than just like a snide comment after a slap in the face. I think it's literally them saying, who are you going to side with?
Right.
And we've seen, like, Iraq, how many trillions of dollars did we put in there? And Iraq's like, we got this airspace. You guys want it? You think if Saddam was there, you think Iran would be shooting stuff over his airspace?
No
way, man.
Yeah, definitely not. But they are a majority Shia country, right?
Well,
it would make sense now that they would align with Iraq. But the only one that I know, let's see, Qatar and Saudi Arabia told us we couldn't shoot from their space. Jordan was shooting down stuff, but they don't. So was, God, who else? Fuck, I don't remember now. Somebody else was shooting down ordnance, but that could just be because it was going over their airspace too, right?
Right.
Who knows? But yeah, they're trying, like, Iran is definitely trying to make people take sides in the region, which is, I don't know if that's the best idea for them because they're not really in control of their own government for the most part. It's kind of, like, it's fractured, to say the least, but that's not the point. The point is that we keep finding these reasons to be in adversarial relationships with people, especially since the rise of communism. And you can tell, like, these old states, quote-unquote statesmen, who are like, we're the ones with the foreign policy experience. Like, well, you guys suck at everything. You fucked up everything so far. That, I wouldn't be touting my experience if my resume was a bunch of fucking red X's. You know what I mean? But they continuously find the same boogeymen. It's still Russia and China after all these years, after 70 years of this bullshit. Like, are we really supposed to believe? Like, I don't give a fuck about Russia or China, to be honest. Like, they don't have the largest air force in the world is our air force, and the second largest air force in the world is our navy. So we're gonna be fine, right? Like, no country can fuck with us. I don't know why people think that that's a thing still. Like, there's going to be some, like, oh, China's got a million man standing army. Like, okay, cool. Are they going to march them across the fucking water?
Well, China's army is like a land based army, right? They are not expeditionary. So I'm not terribly worried about China. Not terribly worried about Russia. But you do bring up a good point in that all these generals have been losing wars since Korea, right? And they all write these books, and they all get to, like, go and teach at Princeton and Columbia and you name it. I'm not calling anybody out, but Petraeus, you know, that guy, he's like, I'm going to cheat on my wife. Not a big deal.
Yeah.
Columbia will still bring me in. And they do these victory laps after 1 year, 2 years, and then you realize that none of the stuff that they did actually worked. So that's kind of one of the reasons I wrote the book, is give that ground perspective of what it was like in Iraq, 04, 05, as opposed to having, you know, Eric Prince wrote a book, and then you have Jeremy Scahill, you have the politicians, you have the generals. All those guys have books. None of them have any idea what it was like on the ground. The mundane 99% of the conversations that I still laugh about today, or like when you're staring down your barrel and you're actually getting ready to pull a trigger, like, what does that feel like? Those guys are like, well, I was sipping my scotch in Saddam's old leather chair. It was made from camel.
Yeah.
And we sure won the shit out of 04. Like, come on, guys.
Well, what was it like on the ground? I didn't get there until 07. And there was the initial invasion and then the period of quasi-stability, and then shit kind of went off the rails for a bit. Especially when we started, we kind of refocused on, I don't know, policing at that point, winning hearts and minds instead of doing kinetic operations.
Well, so we did have a lull, and then the Shias are like, you know, Saddam Hussein was kind of a dick for like the last 30 years. And I think we want retribution.
Jay Shalmati, right?
Yeah, starts exactly.
Fucking everybody up.
Yep. Sadr City was just blowing up. You had all the kill squads that were going through Baghdad that were Shias that were hunting the Sunnis. The Sunnis ended up kind of retreating to the Sunni Triangle, Ramadi, Fallujah, all that stuff. But it was just, there was no rules in 04. Nobody knew what the heck we were doing. And everything was done out of a big, huge base. So it's not like you were out there trying to, like, help with hearts and minds. You were just kind of trying to collect them, if that makes any sense. So if you've ever driven in Europe or, like, been in a taxi in Paris and it's like four lanes but there's eight cars wide, that's right, Baghdad,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then we had the biggest Humvees and we had the up-armored vehicles, and we were going to get through that traffic. It didn't matter how we did it. So running cars off the road, just smashing into, like, a car, it flies off to the side. I mean, there was no hearts and minds of Blackwater. We can sit there and have a debate whether there was value add because we protected those people that helped build Iraq. But at the end of the day, I never saw an army guy where I was like, hey, by the way, we're going to be over here running this mission. This is what we're doing. We didn't talk to each other. There's no Blue Force tracker. There was nothing. The greatest stories I always get is, oh, you were Blackwater. We shot at you guys once. And I said, well, you guys are really fucking terrible shots because none of us got hit. I don't know why everybody wants to say we shot at you, or, oh, you guys tried to run up on our convoy. And we, like, dude, that's just how it was 04, 05.
Kind of the Wild West.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we would say, is like, you're going out into Indian country. Now, Deadwood was big back then too. Yeah. So it was like, we're going out there with the savages and the dirt people and, you know, try to sound like we were cooler than we were. But there was no reporting, right? By the time I left in 10, if somebody farted on a bicycle without having a PT belt on, it was like a 15-6 investigation, which, for those of you who don't know, is like the big investigation by the Army. Back then, you could pretty much do whatever you wanted. And we we were told that, yeah, you're supposed to report your shoes when you run into somebody, but it was happening 8 to 10 times on every run. You think I'm going to come back and be like, there was a white sedan with orange doors that I hit in a traffic circle that had like a statue of a horse, and then I hit another one of those under a bridge, and then I ran another one of those off the road that was by like a mark. Like, dude, GPS didn't exist.
Well, they didn't have the roads you're talking about didn't have fucking names either.
No.
Right? Which it's that to me was a pretty big culture shock, I think. That there were no the only roads that had names were names that we gave them.
Yeah, MSRs, right? Main supply routes.
Yeah, which is pretty interesting, to be honest. And then you mentioned white sedans with orange doors. One of my old platoon sergeants who was at the invasion, and then he was there again in 04, was like, yeah, especially in 04, we were still riding around in canvas top Humvees and shit. And somebody somewhere in some intel department had, quote unquote, figured out that those white sedans with orange doors were fucking hit squads or something. And we were just lighting them up. Turns out they're fucking taxis.
Yeah, they're taxis. Right?
Like, holy shit. Do you really think that a fucking covert hit squad is painting their doors orange? Like, really? That's where we were. But apparently a lot of those guys got clipped for no fucking reason.
Yeah, or they were always VBIDs. So that was the big concern, is car bombs. So you're driving around with the ambassador to Iraq or some mucky muck, a senator, and you see these cars that are flying up on you, and the newest Be on the Lookout report was like, look for a white sedan with orange doors. It's an IED. So then as a civilian in a combat zone, what do you do? Like, do you engage that? Mm-hmm. Do you not engage that? Do you wait and get blown up? Oh, hey, the ambassador got blown up. I mean, these are split-second decisions that are being made by individuals that are not, I mean, myself included, I'm not taking myself out, but we were not like sworn any oath to say, hey, we're going to be under the UCMJ or these are our rules of engagement. Like, you just went out there and did it, and you just got the job done. And at the end of the day, you go back and sleep and read Harry Potter.
Watch One Tree Hill. What were your guys' rules of engagement?
Just pretty much try to make the best decision you could. That was about it. Like, keep all the cars away from us. Mm-hmm. Get from point A to point B as fast as you possibly can. Make sure this guy gets from point A to point B alive and back. And other than that, like, it's just kind of the world's your oyster. Do whatever the heck you want.
Well, you guys got hired, I guess, around the time you joined, or not too long after, by state. You mentioned doing diplomatic security. Who were you doing diplomatic security for exactly? Was it our AMBOs and those people, or was it like the Iraqis?
No, it was us. It was our guys. So diplomatic security turned into this massive umbrella. So my first team was the Regime Crimes Liaison Office, the guys collecting evidence against Saddam Hussein, Kim Ghali. And it was every agency that you had, CIA, NSA, DIA, you name it. And then we go to these different places. We pick up evidence and then we drive it to JSS Justice, where Saddam Hussein eventually got hanged. But it wasn't like always a State Department guy. And sometimes you probably had somebody really important in the vehicle and had no idea. And sometimes you had somebody that you thought was important that was just like a low level junior assistant to Ambassador whoever. Like Negroponte was back there. But it was literally somebody just came up and said, hey, I need to get to the Ministry of whatever. And then here's your map recon. There's no such thing as Garmin in Iraq in 04. So we would just plan the route, plan a secondary route, and say, all right, let's go. Oh, avoid these spots. That's kind of getting towards Sadr City and Haifa Street. We don't want to be near that. But it's just seat of your pants, man. It was crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy that that's how wars were waged. And that was when the war had already, mission accomplished. I got on a boat. It was great.
Yeah, you guys kind of trucked Paul Bremer around for a while as well, who was the I don't remember what his official title was, but it was like he was in charge of the Iraq war from the State Department side, I guess. Not the State Department side, but from building a new government side, I guess.
Yeah, so
which would typically be state, but for some reason they brought in another dude to do that, which is interesting.
So that's how Blackwater got its name, is they protected Paul Bremer. And Paul Bremer was the interim whatever the heck it was until we could get their government stood up. The second that we gave their government to them, Paul Bremer left and Negroponte came in, right? That's what I was talking about earlier, where we switched from a military mission to a diplomatic mission. And that's when they said, holy crap, we have all these people over there, but we don't have anybody to protect them. We have State Department who has a, you know, they have an armed security service, but...
Yeah, DSS, but not enough.
Right. There might have been 5 to 10. Yeah. I don't know. I'm making that up. But there wasn't enough. None of them had combat arms training.
Well, they were using GRS later on, but I don't know how active GRS was when in the DPSEC part back then. I don't think they were around doing DPSEC back then.
The SEALs were doing it with Talibani in northern Iraq.
So they were using active dudes.
Yeah. Hmm. So there was some of that, but there's still not enough Navy SEALs on the planet to be able to take all these guys to everywhere they needed to go.
Yeah.
And the fun part was that once it got dangerous, 04, I think, a lot of those government agency people came in and said, man, that'll really be good for my career. And then a couple of them got hit. And they stopped wanting to go out in the red zone. So it turned into one of these things like John Negroponte never left. And if he did leave, it was on a helicopter. He wasn't going to go out there. He didn't want to go out there. So they would bring everybody into the green zone. And then he left and Khalilzad came in and he wanted to go out all the time. Mm. So it was just, it was all dependent on who wanted to go where and when, how much we worked.
And then there's the, in addition to the duty, the mission, there's all the downtime. And from what it sounds like, you guys had pretty lax rules of engagement. I would imagine that your off-duty behavior was pretty much the same, right? Just do crazy bullshit the whole time you're there.
Are you referring to the naked pool parties that we had?
I don't know about those, but tell me more.
Well, you missed out. They weren't naked, but yeah. Thursday nights were always a party at the pool behind the embassy. Saddam's pool, like a 5-star resort, man. Mm. Absolutely gorgeous. And we would just go out there and just party. And we were the only ones that could get booze because, you know, poor military members under Article 1. So we would just go out there and just get wasted until the MPs would show up and kick us out. But we had one night where... there was a diving board. It had like a 15 meter, maybe it was 10 meter. I can't remember. Diving board. So people started going up there and doing flips off the diving board and then like front flip, back flip. Somebody grabbed a bike, just randomly stole a bike, drove it off. And then because it's Blackwater and it's a bunch of guys that are just trying to figure out how to one up each other, two guys go and grab one of those AC units that are like outside of the buildings, yank it off the wall. Get it to the top of the diving board, fling it off. Everybody cheers. The MPs come. The AC unit is sitting there in the pool the next day, and there's like tape on the diving board that's like, caution, no longer in use. Nobody got to use the diving board ever again. And I can verify it was Blackwater guys, but of course at the time we all circled up and said, oh no, we don't know who would have done that.
Yeah, I mean, what person in their right mind would do something that like that? You know?
Well, it wasn't me.
All right, Shaggy. So what are some other crazy stories that happened over there? Because, you know, ours were, like you said, it was difficult to get booze. So at least that was something. But, you know, most of our shenanigans were not when we came back to refit on the COP or on the FOB and shit. We would mostly just eat and sleep because we were tired. But then you get bored out in Indian country, if you want to call it that, and there's nothing to do, you got to do something. So we're like fucking with each other all the time, putting chem light juice and fucking balloons and launching them at the tanks that are driving by and stuff like that, or just flipping people's cots over. We were just up to all sorts of nonsense. What was that like for you guys? I mean, it's so you're in a dangerous situation, very active. But then there's a lot of boredom. To me, that's a recipe for fucking disaster. When it's a bunch of unsupervised dudes, it doesn't matter if they're 25 or 45, they're going to get in trouble.
Oh, yeah. the nice thing about having contractors is the State Department could hire and fire us at will. Mm. So you could get fired for anything. And people did, right? There was a big steroid bust. They ended up getting rid of like 8 Blackwater guys.
Why would they care about that?
I have no idea. Like the guy at the gym, you could see this guy, his shirt was like straining. The buttons were like getting ready to pop off. He was just so juiced out. And he was supplying the juice to other people.
Sure.
And they all got busted. We had a guy get fired for peeing. I got fired for trying to take the up armor off of our Humvee after we bent the frame by smashing into a bongo truck. Mm. So we got fired for almost everything. So Blackwater would just say, hey, you got fired from Baghdad. Why don't you go to Kirkuk or to Crit or Al Hilla, you name it. But you're just relentlessly fucking with each other. And when you're dealing with dudes that are former like special operations guys, those guys are just, they're just savages, dude. Mm-hmm. So if it was your birthday, you don't tell anybody it's your birthday. But every time somebody had a birthday, we would grab them. We would duct tape them like to a pole. We would just duct tape them to each other, like pour water on them, kick sand in their face. Like it was great. And these are your best friends, right? Just relentlessly messing with you. I mean, and there's like legitimate fights that are happening in the man camp.
Yeah.
Because people are like, I was having sex with this dog handler. That's my dog handler that I was having sex with. And they're going to punch each other in the face over this. It makes absolutely no sense. But it's probably like any other GI unit. You just, instead of flipping cots, like you grab airsoft guns that are the Desert Eagle size and you kick down somebody's door and you point that gun in their face and tell them they have to beg for mercy, and then you leave. Like it's just good fun.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You've also had some. You and I have crossed paths digitally before that I didn't know about it until homeboy told me maybe 6 months ago. I don't remember when he came in, but Matt Marshall was somebody that was working, advising us on some stuff at Black Rifle in the very, very early days, like very early days. And I remember Evan actually mentioned this to me not too long ago. He's like, yeah, you always knew that dude was full of shit. I'm like, yeah, because he never, like, he just, like, asked leading questions and then, like, see? Like, he never actually said anything that made any sense, never contributed anything. Tell me, I think this story is really interesting because you and then to some degree Evan were responsible for this dude finally getting taken down because he was fleecing the fuck out of people, right? Tell me that story.
Oh, dude, it's a saga. So Matt Marshall is probably like the guy you can meet and he makes you feel like you're a Disney princess. This is Matt Marshall. And look, I'm an Air Force guy. I get to Blackwater. I just shut my mouth, right? It's prison rules. You know, you go out to the yard, you find the biggest guy, you suck his dick, you know, you just roll over and you say, hey, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Can you help me out? So Matt Marshall was in my class. It was DSS training class number 4. And he told everybody he was a recon Marine, force recon Marine. Nobody really like gave him shit or asked a whole lot of questions back then because it was like most of the kids that were coming in were either older or they were really young like me. Like you still had a generation of military members that were still in the military, right? So I came in there and the guy could shoot the lights out. I mean, he could absolutely shoot with a pistol. And he was like buttering me up. He buttered everybody up to the point that we get into Iraq and he's our assistant team leader. We go up to Sulaymaniyah, which is outside of Halabja, where Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds. We're gathering evidence against Saddam Hussein and Chemical Ali. You know, taking happy snaps. We're living in a hotel. It's not a bad life. And I write the book, and I get a call from one of the other Blackwater guys, and is like, hey, I'm looking for people in this picture. I was like, are you fucking with me, dude? And he's like, no, who's in this picture with Matt? And I was like, well, that's me. And he's like, oh, the FBI wants to talk to you. So I get on the horn with the FBI. Turns out Matt Marshall had taken his force recon, which in Blackwater, literally created by special operations guys. Nobody checked his DD-214. Mm-hmm. Nobody checked his DD-214. Turns out he was an infantry guy that went into the reserves, got kicked out after like 6 months because he wasn't even showing up to drill weekends. But I digress on that. The pictures that he showed everybody to prove that he was a CIA operative and that he was like super secret squirrel are these pictures of him in a C-130. And I'm sitting there right next to him with a dip in my mouth and my Lowe's number 48 Jimmy Johnson hat on. Mm-hmm. And the FBI's like, hey, what are these pictures? I told him exactly where the pictures were taken. And he's like, were you guys in the CIA? And I was like, no, dude, I wasn't even cool enough to be in the CIA. Well, Matt had strung it together that he was in the CIA right after September 11th. So September 12th, he was in Afghanistan, used pictures from northern Iraq to prove that. And then he was the guy that lays the target for al-Zarqawi's death in Baghdad in 05.
So he's like Forrest Gump.
Yeah, like he was everywhere. He got the prayer beads off of Zarqawi and gave those to this billionaire Mike Gogan. Mm. And
who he then proceeded to fleece for millions of dollars.
Yeah.
In Whitefish, right?
Yeah, up in Whitefish, Montana. So I was the one that took all those pictures and said, look, I have that exact same picture. I'm standing in that same spot. 30 seconds later, you can see the same donkey. You can see the same woman. This is Sulaymaniyah, Iraq. And I can't remember the name of the small little village, but it was like you take a left at Cham Chamal and you go back in there and did an affidavit. And Matt Marshall was like, yeah, I guess I better plead guilty. So now he's doing 7 years. I put it in the book because it's just so entertaining that you have guys from like Black Hawk Down, like Hoot, right?
Yeah.
Those guys, they worked for Blackwater. Some of the baddest people on the planet worked for Blackwater. And then you have guys like Matt Marshall that, how the hell did he get away with it that long? It's amazing. Like you almost have to give him credit. He's a genius.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it shows that what do they call that? The construction or the road guard vest, safety vest theory, where if you wear a safety vest and a helmet and you just walk with confidence, you can walk anywhere you want. Nobody will ever stop you. Right.
Yeah.
Because they just think, oh, he's clearly working. Right. Otherwise, nobody would wear that otherwise. But yeah, I remember things started to not add up because none of us particularly knew him that well. Things started to not add up. I'm like, well, I can just request his records from one records way in St. Louis, Missouri, buddy, because that's where they're all held. It's like, all right, cool. Let's do that. Let's put in a request for those records. And yeah, we saw that there was nothing. There were no records. I mean, there were, but it was like, as you said, very brief. And not unspectacular. I guess it's spectacular to get kicked out before you even start.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was like, oh shit. All right, cool. I guess we better let somebody know about this. Cause no, I think we actually reached out to law enforcement. I think that is what precipitated the investigation or maybe we reached out to the old man. I don't remember.
I know Gogan reached out to the FBI cause
I think maybe we reached out to him and let him know.
Cause
Matt was always talking about, that was one of the reasons I think, if I remember correctly, it was a long time ago, but I think that's one of the ways he wormed his way into our situation is because his fucking best friend over here is a billionaire, right? So,
well, he's a billionaire, and Matt said, here's the problem with what the CIA does, is we can't do any cool shit because it takes too much money to get time and energy to get funding. And I've got this Department of Homeland Security guy. He's kidnapped down in South America. Hey, Mike. Can you kick me down $650,000? Mm. I'll go rescue this dude. I will lead the mission. Mm. And then he went down there, rescued the guy. Didn't make any news, of course, because it's all under the table. Mm. And he did this 3 or 4 times with Mike. Stole somewhere around $3.2 million. And then on top of that, Amintor was their PMC group they created. Mm. Mike Gogan put $11.5 million into that. Never saw any contract out of it.
Except for guarding his own house, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean.
But that's it. Oh, my God.
So that's where he, like, instead of going down and like rescuing kidnap victims, he went to Florida and bought a bunch of watches and knocked somebody up. And by the end of it, he was grasping so hard that he told Mike that he had brain cancer. He went to the Mayo Clinic. He had brain cancer, and that he could still do moderate physical activity and sexual activity, but those were the only two things. I'm guessing he threw the sexual activity thing in there for his wife,
or because he got somebody pregnant.
Well, yeah.
Although maybe Mike didn't know about that.
I don't know that Mike knew about that, but
yeah,
the guy's doing 7 years in the pen, and like Blackwater's like herpes. It's the gift that keeps on giving. Like. I thought I was done with this. I wrote a book. Next thing I know, I'm in an FBI investigation. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just this ragtag group of people that now all are, have like their oxygen tanks and are like, put me in, coach. I'm ready.
Yeah, there's a lot of it on our side too. Like, I can, if society collapsed and I had to go live in the woods, I'd be fine with that, right? But going to war in the state that I'm in right now, there's no fucking way. Like, I'm 43 years old, for Christ's sake. Like, it's a different, I mean, I could get myself into shape for it with some time, but I definitely, there's a lot of dudes who were in a bunch of gunfights back in the day who still think that they can get into gunfights right now and win. And maybe that's true against Iraqis because they can't shoot for shit. But not in northern Afghanistan. They're not a fight up there. So
I just imagine Eric Prince getting all the Blackwater guys together, and he's like, all right, we got to go into Israel, and then we're going to go into Iran. And everybody like raises their walkers with the tennis balls on the bottom. Yeah. Actually, we wouldn't have tennis balls. We'd have like fake grenades on the bottom of our walkers because we'd look really cool.
Sure.
But dude, some of those guys that were in Blackwater were already in their mid to late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And now I'm 43 years old and I'm thinking, dude, I can't believe you went over and did that.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane.
So the book is Guns, Girls, and Greed. Tell me more about what's in the book.
So the book is chronological. So the first few chapters, you're going to have to go through dysentery with me.
Mm.
You just are, right? Waffle stomping those turds down the shower. Like, sure. It is absolute. The Baghdad bug ravages every jejunum. And then it's really like, it's almost a growing up story of being able to say, I went over there, I wanted to help. And then you probably felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to help for the first 3 months. 3 to 6 months, you're like, okay, I don't know what we're really doing here. 6 to 9 months, you're like, okay, I don't really give a shit. And then 9 to 12 is like, I just got to get the fuck out of here. I'm counting down days. So
that's about right.
It's that cycle and that process of like how individuals that are in combat think. But you put the spin on it that we're technically civilians. So we don't have the same rules of engagement. We can party. There's a ton of party stories in there of just us acting like idiots. And I want the reader to kind of just read through and see that all that same crap that happens to like soldiers happens to PMCs.
Mm.
What PMCs don't have is they don't have any fallback. When people say PMCs are cheaper than military members, they're right. Because you're not paying for their insurance, their housing, all that crap that comes with being in the military, you don't pay for that. You only get paid while you're on the ground. And then you come home and there's no support system. And I'm not boo-hooing, right? Like, I made a shit ton of money. But there's no VA for PMCs.
Right.
Our suicide rate in PMCs is exponentially higher than military members. Because you deploy as a single person. You don't come back with your unit where you get to hang out with all your buddies. Your buddy's in Tennessee, you're in Florida. And what are you going to do? Text back and forth a few times and be like, oh, I'm so sad. No, it's going to be like, oh, what about those good times? And then you just keep going back to Iraq. You just keep doing it, man. So it's, I say like war is toxic, but it's intoxicating. Like you know how bad it is for you, but you just keep going back, whether it's for the money or the camaraderie. Or think, remember how easy life was? Like somebody washed your laundry, made your food, you woke up, worked out, and then you had some lunch, and then you do a run or whatever, you come back, you eat, go to sleep. Like, it's just an easy life. It's stressful, but it's not stressful in the way like dealing with your wife and your kids is. It's stressful in a way like, I guess if that rocket hits, I might die, which would be a huge bummer.
Yeah, there's something to be said about the prolonged exposure to stress, for sure, but life was quite a bit simpler back then. And I think that's why a lot of dudes, I mean, they couldn't handle it in garrison when we got back. They just couldn't handle being stagnant, sitting around all the time. It fucking, they would lose their minds, DUIs and fucking everything. It stands to reason that you guys would have had a bigger problem with suicide, for sure. Because there's no light at the end of the tunnel. It's just the next contract, really. So how did you eventually break yourself out of that cycle?
Oh, it was easy. I got fired. Yeah, that makes it a little easier. Yeah. Look, I was 23. I knew that I was doing it for the cash, and I wasn't going to stay there forever. A lot of those guys are still doing the PMC game. They did it for like 10, 15. Some are in their 20 year of doing some kind of PMC. I initially got on the QRF in Baghdad. And the QRF was like the cool guys, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, we would take people out with our big Humvees. We'd ram into cars. Mm-hmm. Every video you've seen on YouTube of Blackwater is like the QRF. And that's the team I was on. And if I go to the Senate, I'll tell everybody that it definitely wasn't me in that car. But once I got fired for, so we hit this bongo truck going probably 50 miles an hour. And those bongo trucks are made of fucking Superman.
Yeah. It's like a fucking 1950s Buick or some shit.
Yeah.
It's just all steel.
Solid steel. We smash this thing to the point.
It doesn't look like much either.
No.
It looks like you could just tip that bitch over, but they're heavy as shit.
Yeah. It looks like you could just smoosh it with your hands. Right. So we hit this thing and it bends the frame of our Humvee, up armored Humvee. Mm-hmm. We got all the up armor from KBR. So we decided we were going to take the up armor off. Mm. KBR got all butt hurt because I was trying to borrow their tools to take off the up armor. State Department comes in and says, oh, you're right. That wasn't their armor. They were just all pissed off. You're fired anyway. So they sent me up to Kirkuk because that's how you get fired in Iraq. And I stayed up in Iraq for another 7-8 months. And then I think it must have been my going away party. And I wasn't drinking for probably months before that. And dude, I just got so fucking wasted. And you're at the embassy. Like this is sovereign State Department ground.
Yeah.
And I went into the embassy to take a leak. And apparently what I was told is I beat the shit out of the embassy bathroom. Like, punched out the mirror. I don't know. I don't know what I did. I hope it was like on Walk Hard where he like rips the sink off and it goes, that's what I hope it looked like. I probably didn't. And then I came back out and started drinking again and they put me to bed and I almost missed my flight back to Baghdad to get home. So I got fired again after that. And it was at that point where I was like, I can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
Like even at 24, 25 years old, like, I can't be the person that's going to be like going back and forth to Iraq because by then I had alienated my family, every relationship I had. I was an asshole. I mean, you could say PTSD now, but 04, 05 was like PTSD. It's cool.
I don't think it's that. I think it's like you're tuned up to fight.
Yeah.
Like if you tried to have a reasonable conversation with somebody 2 minutes after they got into a fight with someone else, even here, they're going to fucking be a dick.
Yeah. Right,
like your body is preparing itself to fuck something up, so that's what you're looking to do is fuck something up.
Yeah,
I don't think that's PTSD at all, because I remember coming back, and for a couple of weeks, like we were, this is worse for you guys because there's no redeployment process at all. But I was driving, or I was riding down the streets of Sadr City on a Sunday, and by Wednesday I was driving my car on Fort Bragg, which is not how that should work at all, right? There should definitely be some time to decompress. But you could feel it. It wasn't like I wasn't anxious or nervous about bombs and shit like that. That came later.
Right.
At the first couple of weeks at least, I was like still in that let's fuck something up mode, you know what I mean? Which is not, you're not supposed to be like that, just cruising around the streets.
Yeah, I remember I came back on leave and I had a Land Rover, of course, because I'm a dumb contractor. Mm-hmm. So I spent all my money. And dude, I was tailgating this person so hard because I was so used to driving in Baghdad.
Right.
This person like pulled off on the side of the road and stared at me like I was the biggest butthole on the planet. And I was like, what's the problem? Like this is how I've been driving for the last 6-7 months.
Yeah.
Now I come home and it's like, oh, there's rules to the road. You're not supposed to like tailgate somebody going through the switchbacks. I apologize. Oh, I guess I'm the butthole here.
Yeah, you were. That's maybe we'll figure it out one day, but today is not that day.
No,
unfortunately. We got to get going, but thanks for coming today. The book is Guns, Girls, and Greed. I was a Blackwater mercenary in Iraq. Morgan Lorette is the author. Is there anything else you want to share with these dicks? Where to find you? Where to find the book? Are you doing any signings or anything?
No signing set up yet, but you can get the book on Amazon. Jay Moore, the actor, read the audio. So
if you
guys can't read like me, you can listen to somebody's beautiful voice.
I always listen to the audio book.
Yeah. And then if you guys want to hit me up on Instagram or X or TikTok, I shake my tits on TikTok. You know, it's just BlackwaterDude1.
There you go.
Track me down.
There you go. Thanks for coming today. I appreciate the conversation.
No, thanks for having me, man.
Yes, sir. Anytime. We'll do it again soon. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.